This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meat and Three, it's the final episode of our series on global trade. We're thinking futuristically, from China's ambitious plans for a new Silk Road to the future of borders and automation.
If you're a banana, you know, it's easy to cross the border. But if you're a person who's trying to follow the jobs, it's a lot more difficult, if not impossible, to do so in an authorized and safe fashion.
They love food trucks and they love growing your own food because these things are not dependent on essentially government systems. So there's a whole politics to pretzels on the dark web.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the air.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Greg, how are you, my friend?
Oh, you know, same as last week, probably same as next week. how about you, bud?
Yeah, we're just still caught in this sort of loop of time being somewhat meaningless, but still marching on. I'm okay, actually. I'm having a pretty okay couple of days. I got to do something very fun yesterday, and I think getting to do something, getting to do fun things these days is few and far between. Yeah, well,
I remember those being good, but give me a refresher. It's been so long.
Yeah, I left the apartment, and ooh. I went to the bar at Amore Margot, which has been dormant, you know, since basically since Christmas Eve. We did do a Valentine's Day event because you know, we wanted to, you know, make sure people knew that we're still here and still intending to be here. Just a quick update on that. We are planning to reopen on April 1st at Amore Margot. So we may do some outdoor service prior to that, but we're not going to open Amore Reserve, the new space, until at least April 1st. Anyway, went to the bar, met up with a good friend, Nick Bennett, who, you know, have you been watching his Instagram show, Puppet Tavern?
Oh, it's amazing! Yeah, it's been one of the YouTube silver linings of this last, you know, incredibly long year.
Yeah, that's right. He started a YouTube channel as well, but he started it out on Instagram, and it's and you can find it there, and it's got a link to the YouTube channels as well. But it's great. It's he has this puppet that was custom made of him some years ago, and now he uses it to make a show. Where he uses puppets, not just that one, but other ones, to talk about, you know, our world, bartending, spirits, booze, drink making, etc. And I've done two with him in the past. I did one on Bitters and one on Amaro's. Shocker that I was in those episodes. And, you know, I play sort of the live character, and then there's puppets all around. But yesterday, he wanted to do another one where we talked about vermouth, and he brought a puppet with him that I'll put up a photo in the show notes that a fan of his show made for him. Has nothing to do with me, but this puppet looks sort of like a brown Oscar the Grouch, you know, kind of hairy and weird looking, big googly eyes. It's wearing an apron like a bartender. On the apron is an I Heart Bitters pin, the pin from my bar, Amore Margot. On the apron is an I'm Just Here for the Drinks pin, the pin from my book, I'm Just Here for the Drinks. And the character is wearing a big pair of red horn-rimmed glasses, which, of course, I'm known for wearing. So basically, some fan of Nick's made him a puppet that is effectively me. The fan named it Amaro the Grouch. Nick's wife is a lawyer, and she says, we can't go with that name, so we're going to come up with a different name. But we at least introduced the character at the end of the segment yesterday. So the character is going to become a member of the show, the troupe, or what have you. And moving forward, not yesterday, he only had one line yesterday, but moving forward, I'll be the voice of whatever this character's name finally comes out to be.
So you've made shoes, puzzles, locks, and now you're part of a puppet troupe. You've had a busy quarantine, Souther.
Yeah. I've pivoted so much. I'm spinning like a ballerina. I don't pivot, I pirouette. Yeah, it's charming and funny and stupid, and you know, it just it, it boasts to the creativity of our community during these times of ridiculousness. And I think it's he couldn't remember the guy's name, but he's going to give me this guy's name, and of course I'm going to reach out to him and thank him profusely for making this puzzle a puppet of me. It's pretty
Because I've seen the pictures, and I encourage everybody who's listening to also look at the pictures. This ain't a sock puppet, folks. This is some like real Sesame Street type shit. Like it would be right at home on an actual children's program were it not explicitly selling alcohol.
The whole show in general is that and he does it just for fun and creativity. He doesn't monetize it in any way, but they're great. They're really well put together. He's learning a lot about editing and that sort of thing, and their scripts, it's a serious endeavor for him, even though it's just for creative release. Super fun. So yeah, check out Nick Bennett. He's on Instagram at the Nick B. And then also you can search for the hashtag Puppet Tavern and check them out on YouTube as well. It's really, really charming and fun. And there's about, I don't know, it looks like there's about 15, 17 episodes up now.
It has been one of the we're all desperately searching for silver linings here. It has been one of the nice things to see is everyone kind of, branch out and do their own things in this time, whether it's, shout out to Blake and his business partner for doing day and night cocktails.
Yeah, Blake Walker and Sean Johnson, two former Amore Amargo. Nick Bennett, also former Amore Amargo. Maybe it's Amore Amargo.
Yeah, you're just an incubator for weird stuff that other people go out there and do when hard times hit.
Lindsay Madison, formerly of Amore Amargo, she put out a book that she self-published that's a bunch of art connected to cocktail recipes. The team, they're out there, they're doing it.
That's awesome, man. It is nice to see people say, okay, what am I gonna do with this time? How am I gonna use this to explore that I haven't had the chance to explore before? And I've thought that's been kind of cool. It's been really fun to see all these other things. You know, my Will Wyatt, who was on the show last summer, mm-hmm. God, almost a year ago now, is now running a burrito pop-up. I knew the guy could make a drink. I don't know what's in this orange sauce that he puts on his burritos, but I want to be able to buy it by the gallon. So it's cool seeing all of these little hidden talents that everyone's been giving some time to incubate. And there we go. That's your silver lining for the week, everybody.
Yeah, right.
The good news hour with Greg and Souther starts right now.
Yeah, I mean, again,
someone's got to do it, man.
I want to back that up and say, yeah, I'm excited to see the things that people are out there doing, but I'm not surprised in any way. I think our personality type to be in our field dictates that we are somewhat, extroverted and maybe a little bit alpha and definitely creative. So it's not a shock to me to see people explore creativity to generate interest, just to do it, to have an outlet or to even generate income. So I'm happy to see it.
Absolutely. We're a creative, restless breed. We can't sit still for very long before we have an urge to do something, anything, whether it's something old or reinventing something new. And speaking of taking something old and reinventing it into something new, thank you.
That's a good
one. Patting myself on the back for it right now. Who do we have in the studio with us today, Souther?
We got Freddie Noe with us here from Booker, from Beam, and he's going to talk to us. He's about being the eighth generation distiller at Jim Beam, and not only standing next to the tradition and legacy that brand upholds, but also innovating and creating new things. So Freddie, so thankful for your time. Thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, guys, glad to be here and excited to share some of the inner workings of kind of innovation, as you said and touched on, and kind of what my day to day is, and kind of representing this long lineage of bourbon history. So excited to be here and glad it worked out that I could join.
Hey, thanks so much. You told us off the air that you're sitting in your dad's man cave of a garage. Are you sipping on something nice?
Right?
Are you sipping on something nice while you chat with us?
Actually, I am. So I'm sipping on some Knob Creek rye. We had done a little bit of a packaging update on the Knob Creek line. And I had done a tasting last week with the new packaging and showed it off to some of our team. And so it was sitting here, and it was the first one in the line on the bar as I came in. And I thought, you know what? That sounds good. So I'm having a Knob Creek rye.
Spoiled for choice. I'm sure you're spoiled for choice in that environment. You're like the first one of many, many on the bar here. I'm just going to grab the first one. Talk to us a little bit about the fact that you are eighth generation in this position with this company. Is that something that you feel you were, I don't want to say forced, but because of being, okay, well, you know, dad was seven. Am I going to take up the mantle, you know, or like, where does that fall in? You know, you're obviously slated to be in the family business in some way. How does that work?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess what's cool is growing up, you know, people say, when did you realize what Jim Beam was as a, not just, you know, as your great, great grandfather, but as a, you know, as a whiskey or as a person that made this real famous or world famous whiskey. And, you know, I don't really have an answer of when it kind of clicked that scenario, you know, and I really like that because much like my dad, we grew up as children, you know, normal children. I always joke and say, you know, somebody said, what's it like growing up Jim Beam's great-great-grandson? I said, it's just a normal life. We tend to host a little bit more parties, and everybody laughs because they think, you know, big party. But really what we hosted dinners with a lot of our sales folks for thank yous, whether they're meeting their sales numbers or whatever. So we would host these dinners and still do. To give thanks and to give them a little bit deeper dive into what it means to be a part of the Beam family. And so, you know, I just, like I said, I thought we just had a few more parties than the rest of my friends did until I got to be a teenager. You know, around that time, I knew what Jim Beam was. But it was never pressure to come into the industry. You know, that's my point of it was a childhood. And even my dad, when I talked to him about it, that was the same way my granddaddy did it, you know. And a lot of that stems from granddaddy saying to me and to dad and dad as well, you know, it's your ride, which means it's your life. You know, you got to be happy in what you do. And, you know, yeah, there's, you know, for instance, for me, there's seven generations that came before me. But, you know, when my grandfather was close to passing, he said, you know, there's a great opportunity there. You know, there's a lot of tradition and I know you'll learn about it. You know, you're a very curious person. But if it's not in your heart, you know, don't feel obligated to work there. Do what's in your heart and what makes you happy. And every generation before you will be okay with it. So it's just, you know, and that's the same way I treat it with my kids is it's there if you want it right now. If you want to come with me, you can go any day, anytime. You know, and if you don't ever want to go, that's fine as well. You know, it's your childhood. You know, you let it be a part of. You know, there's certain things like the milestone barrels when we fill, like last year's 16 millionth was pretty cool. It was the first one that my son Booker, Frederick Booker, No. V, he was about a little over a year old. So it was really the first one he was seeing, and my daughter Braylee was there with us. She's 12. And so, you know, it was really the first one that my kind of whole family now was a part of. And so you know, Braylee was excited to be there, and obviously Booker didn't have a clue what was going on. You know, just things like that. I will kind of, if she was to say no, she didn't want to, I'd probably urge her to come with me because I remember those, and I remember hating to go to like that barrel fill because I had to dress up. You know, I had to look nice,
right?
But you know, there's a couple photos I'm looking at right now here in this garage of me and Granddad, my grandmother Annis, and my mom and dad standing by the. I think it's the. Looks like the 10 millionth or maybe 9 million. I can't tell there. But either way, you know, that's a fond memory for me now. I remember that day and just thinking back of the times I had with them, it's fun. So I hope that, you know, she doesn't think of it as a bear forever, you know.
Sure. I mean,
thanks for having it there.
I would relate that to, you know, any set of photos that are on the walls around my grandfather's house. You know, mm-hmm. It's just our own personal family history. It's just that your personal family history happens to also sort of touch literally millions of people around the world. Like the macro and the micro view of the same situation, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm excited to share the story, and people are like, man, you know, you're so passionate, and you've got so much, you know, so many stories. And I'm like, I'm just excited that there's people sitting around listening to me tell them, you know. it's kind of cool. But I think, you know, coming from that, this line, I said, you know, when you kind of get to a place where you do understand what Jim Beam is, the person, you know, kind of what he did, and then why the brand is kind of named after him. You know, I became extremely curious about what, you know, what were these folks doing? You know, were they, I just kind of imagined them being like my granddaddy because that's what he did, you know? But so the more I read about them as I got a little bit older, you know, in American Still Life book that was wrote about our family, I read some of that when I was about to graduate high school. And just, you know, understanding where these people, starting to try to understand where these people were coming from. And, you know, it's just so crazy to think that this family has stuck at this industry or been such a key piece, whether it be the you know, the kind of revamp after Prohibition with Jim Beam or, you know, Jacob, who started it in 1795 for us, just coming here to Kentucky on a land grant. From the U.S. government to grow corn, and he ran a grain mill, and you know, at that time distilling was essentially a farm task. You know, everybody, from talking with my grandfather, everybody had a still. He said everybody carried a still on their back, which meant they had a small still, and you know, if they had excess grain, they'd distill it. So, you know, just thinking he come here with the idea of just moving his family here. And starting a new life. His father passed away when he was 6 and at 29 years old. So I'm sure he probably thought his life was going to be short, and he wanted to set some roots for his family. And, you know, geez, you know, what would Jacob say today? You know, thinking 200 and here we are, 226 year, I guess you would say, as we've kind of got in here. So, yeah, you know, it's for me, it was I became very curious about those folks and what they did. Then when you start understanding the tie to the industry and how that has had an impact, or, you know, how our family has had an impact on the industry and vice versa, the industry on our family, it starts to become such a proud moment when you understand those things. And I guess my grandfather Booker passed when I was 16. I would say that's probably when it really grabbed my attention that this was something I was interested in, because so many people came to his wake and talked about the impact that he had on their life, or that my family's whiskey had on their life, you know, through providing for their family. And it's such a fun place to work. You know, I just heard so much about this, you know, I knew there was something that I wanted to at least fill out, you know, so that's kind of where it started for me at 16, was just, you know, knowing there was a lot there to learn, because granddaddy had told me that, you know, he, one of his things was, if you go in that distillery and you don't learn something every day, it's your own damn fault, boy. And I thought, damn, that's a long, I'm thinking I go to school. I'm like, I want to kind of get away from the learning side of things. You know, I want to do some action, I guess. I didn't know, but you know, now I see that, and it's true. It's there for you to learn it. You know, if you want to run and, you know, on a daily basis, we're making some of the world's finest whiskey, you know, Jim Beam, Knob Creek, Booker's, Baker's. But other times, you know, if you get a wild hair, you got the opportunity to learn, and by making tweaks to the system, you learn more about your craft, and at that same time, you may learn more about how to create a product that is something someone else enjoys. You know, expanding the whiskey following, and as you look at it, that's kind of what our family's done over time. We kind of, you know, we've been at it for a long time. Like I said, 226 years, and at every kind of critical juncture in the industry, there's a Beam family member there to kind of help usher it to the next, you know. And it's great to be able to I love it, because, like, for instance, Googling your family tree, mine is extensively deep and easily accessible. You know, my wife and I looked at it and tried to do some research on her side of the family. And there's just not a lot of stuff that's out there because it's got to be fed in by somebody. And
right.
Know that there's so many people out there that have an interest in this and that our family, you know, not just my direct descendants, just the Beam name itself as well is it mean, I take a lot of pride in being a representative of that as well.
I mean, it's an alluring and captivating story to the outsider, to me, to Greg, I'm sure, to our mm-hmm. listeners. To be immersed in it, there seems like it's a gravity that's going to pull you in such a way that you're not going to be able to deny it. In my notes here it says you joined the distillery team in 2013, not quite that long ago. Does that mean you were some other capacity, or that's when you first stepped into any
that's
kind of
when
role?
I first stepped into any. Well, I had done two internships before that, spending 4 months in Chicago doing a marketing internship, and then I also spent roughly 3 months, I'd say, in operations the summer prior to my graduation. So that's when I graduated, was December of 2012. And then I started January 7th of 2013. And that was my official first date. But I had been around the distillery. I was very close with the manager at the time, Tommy Kroom, who had worked with my grandfather, worked with my dad, obviously. And then it's kind of funny, when I was officially moved to supervisor in the distillery, that Monday was his last Monday. He was retiring on Friday. So it was kind of like a handing of the baton. And he had told me, you'll do just fine. I've worked with you a little bit here and there. And then, in your time down here, when I was, doing those internships, he said, I know you've got the eye like your granddad. I'm proud to kind of hand it over to you. So, it was a good feeling for me, and that was in 2014. So I had spent roughly over 2 years going around each department. From I started in the distillery, spent 6 months, and then the rest of that kind of 2 year span there, I went around from bottling, processing, receiving, shipping, warehousing, and just literally learning everything there was to learn about the operation from the grain coming in the door to the boxes going out the door. And really, I wish everybody could do that. I say that if when we get new hired people in management, they say, what's something that you would implement if you could do it? And I said, I would make every person that gets hired here spend a certain amount of time learning this entire thing, because there's a lot of intrigue, like you say, for me being a part of it. And then when you get into it, there's so much to learn, and the inner workings of how all of it kind of flows together, and how there is kind of like this kind of family feeling, especially how we've built it at Beam between all the departments and the whole group. It really just draws you in. And so then from that point, I moved into bottling for a little while, and then went to the supervisor in the distillery right there after I did that rotation. And basically from that point, I've been involved in, supervising the on-shift operators. We are a union environment. I was a fermentation coordinator, manager that we created, fermentation manager, kind of oversaw both processes at our two distilleries and tried to bring the processes closer together. And that kind of morphed in about that time was when Little Book started coming together. And so my role kind of morphed into eighth generation distiller, where I kept the role of kind of keeper of the knowledge between the two distilleries and trying to uphold the Beam family quality, and then kind of a little more forward facing role, which kind of gets me to getting with you guys and working on innovation and spending more time out there telling some of these stories and showing people that there's a family behind these family of brands, some of the ones I named earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that to me sounds fascinating, to move through the entire place and see each of the, different aspects of operation. Certainly probably gave you the opportunity to focus in on what it is you kind of really wanted to do, or maybe even it showed you where your talent really lay. So let's take a break real quick and hear from our sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. We're going to come back and keep talking with Freddie Noe, eighth generation of the Beam brand. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy to use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "It's so good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
And we are back. You are listening to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Today we are talking with eighth generation Beam distiller Freddie Noe. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about getting you learning the ropes about every aspect of the family business and the distillery. It sounds like you know the place inside and out. And now I want to talk a little bit about you sort of putting your own stamp on it. You looking at it and saying, okay, this is the part of this that I'm really interested in. This is where I think I can really make a contribution to this legacy. And currently it sounds like that's manifesting itself as Little Book. So talk to us a little bit about that. And first of all, what Little Book even is.
Yeah. You know, honestly, Little Book kind of stemmed from that time, you know, where I got to learn everything. I spent time with our R&D department and they kind of tasked me with coming up with a couple prototype liquids. You know, I worked with them on projects while I was there, but given the fact I was just there for a short period of time, they weren't going to dump a project on me and have me learn the system of doing all the paperwork and all that jazz. So they kind of let me be a liaison on the projects and then kind of tasked me to kind of pitch to them as if I had a project, but skipped all the kind of paperwork part of it. So I, you know, that they told me that at the beginning and I don't even know where it come from, but really, it's kind of funny. I shared it with a couple of new folks that are working on our product development team. I said, you know, there's no bad idea in my opinion. Now I can tell you that when we get to the end of it, we may not want to trial it right now. Or it might not be a fit for us currently, but I don't think there's a bad idea when it comes to trying to expand the palette of flavor that's available for whiskey. And I think American whiskey and the use of many different grains has the best opportunity to kind of expand that portfolio and really start to tell a deeper, broader story about whiskey. And I said, you know, I say that because, you know, when I was younger, the word blending in bourbon, you know, it went to a bad connotation, a bad note. You know, people associated that with neutral spirits and caramel colorings.
I think we're still battling that a little bit. You know, the average consumer still considers the word blending on any bottle of whiskey, American or otherwise, to somewhat carry an air of lesser. And I think we need to get a better education out there. So glad to hear you touching on that.
Yeah, that's the point of what Little Book is, was really to show people there's more to American whiskey than just bourbon, and that by taking these different liquid streams, you can expand this horizon and this portfolio. You know, this portfolio I'm saying is American whiskey, and obviously our portfolio at Beam as well. But so, like I say, I told these folks this notion of Little Book that's, you know, this Class A blend literally came from me learning the distillery and saying, what would you do if you took corn whiskey, rye whiskey, and malt whiskey, blended them together to the percentage of the Jim Beam mash bill, and they were aged 4 years old, would it taste like bourbon? Would it taste like Jim Beam? And that's really where it started, was just as I was learning the distillery. I don't even know. I think it was before I was even in the distillery, just me reading books and learning about making whiskey. I thought, you know, you do this before, but what if you made these whiskeys and then you bring them together afterwards? Is it the same thing? I could see if I said that to my dad at that time, him thinking, boy, you're looking at this thing all wrong, you know? So in reality, I kind of housed that thought. And at some point during this internship, or not, I guess not internship, it was when I call it internship because it was kind of, like I say, a short stint with research and development. But during that time there, as this idea came back to my brain, and luckily we had some four-year-old of each of those whiskey. You know, we did some experimentation with malt whiskey just to see how it would run on our column still, is essentially where it initiated. We had rye whiskey, obviously, and we had corn whiskey as well. And so that's what I created, was a prototype of a blend versus going at it from the grain bill style. It was not that good. Obviously our rye whiskey has a good percentage of corn in it. The corn whiskey, 80% corn. So, and at 4 years old, you know, you're not getting a load of flavor from the barrel just yet. You know, I think you're still 2 years removed from a lot of good character. So a lot of the grain character still holds true at four for me. And so it was just a very corn-forward, almost corn whiskey blend is kind of what it landed at. But I cut it to 80 proof, and I called it Jim Beam Blended. And that was kind of the pitch to them. Like I said, it wasn't very good, so that idea got housed pretty quickly in the back of my head again.
But I think what you're really describing here is that curiosity is sort of the genesis of innovation, right? If you hadn't been curious enough to say to yourself, well, we can put these things, all three of them together in the still and bring them out and then rest them in a barrel for 4 years, can we put these three things separately and let them rest for 4 years and then blend them? Will we have the same thing, right? It seems like a pretty solidly founded, you know, somewhat scientifically minded question that led you somewhere that maybe you didn't expect to wind up, but it certainly then opened the door for you to say, well, okay, now I know what that did. So how can I use that information?
Absolutely. Well, you know, at that time it was, you know, I guess it was 2014 for that. That was the last place I went before I moved on to supervision. With that, you know, it gave me the opportunity at least to think that what I was initially thinking was wrong, but I was still thinking, you know, I want to make this right. You know, that's what my dad said, why I'm so good is I'm very curious. And I won't take no for an answer. If you tell me I can't, he said, if I told you couldn't run through that brick wall, you'd stand here until you ran through that brick wall. He said that when I was a kid a lot, you know.
Sure.
But I think it translated well.
Curious and stubborn is a great combination.
I think so. If you're looking to, like I said, if you're trying to expand whiskey horizon, if you're trying to share more with the world, you know, I think that's a lot of what I look to do is I'm anxious to see what kind of other things can be created. So that's kind of what led me to Little Book. And that curiosity at first, you know, like you're going to have a different blend every year. It was, you know, people thought it was kind of daunting as well. You know, how are you going to run out of ideas? And I just, you know, I kind of, and it's still to this day, it's how I do it. I let the whiskey do the talking. You know, I look through our inventories. I've spent time at other distilleries within Beam Suntory. You know, we have Canadian whiskey distillers. Obviously, it's with the Suntory name, we have Japanese whiskey distilleries. We have tequila. We have rum. So I've spent time at some of these distilleries, and I've interjected, you know, Canadian whiskey in Little Book Chapter 2. And I've got thoughts to bring others in down the road as well. And But a lot of it is let the whiskey do the talking. That's the big thing. If you said in a lot of our product development meetings, you would hear me say, I like to try to draw some conclusions and get them on paper. That way we kind of, it's hypothesis. You know, you look at it and then you see where it lands. But yeah, generally speaking, I like to let the whiskey do the talking. And when, you know, for instance, I just finished up the next chapter of Little Book, which will be coming out here in September. And that one was one, you know, I keep the lips kind of sealed till we get to certain places in the projects just because things can change. But I'm excited to tell this story because there is a big kind of, I would say big, but there's a good showcase of how letting the whiskey kind of guide you, in my opinion, for a Little Book Chapter 5 that really, I think, people will hopefully draw them to a better term to blending, you know, going back to our thought of that's what Little Book kind of set out to do, was expand the flavor profile of American whiskey, but also to fill that role as well, to bring blending to the top, I should say. That it doesn't have to be about grain neutral spirits. That I guess what I've come to see is that the Class A blend is what you would call it, where it's straight spirits being blended, or straight whiskeys in Little Book's cases.
Sure. Talk to us a little bit more about Little Book. You mentioned Chapter 5. You're releasing it as chapters. How often does a chapter come out? What do the chapters mean?
We're doing one chapter a year, and essentially it's at first it was the only project I was kind of leading. We'll talk to kind of, you know, here lately I've been working a little bit more on some other brands as well, on some of the limited offerings, and but generally, like I said, Little Book was the first brand that I kind of had, and it is my own there. Little Book is the nickname that my grandfather Booker gave me when I was a kid. So it's a family nickname that's stuck for quite a while. And, you know, it the name came after we were doing some work on the whiskey. And then the more I started thinking about it, if I'm going to be doing some blending and something, you know, bringing this new way into Beam, I guess, to look at whiskey and to taste whiskey differently, it needed to be at cask strength, I felt, because a lot of what my granddad said was that's the way whiskey used to be, and in his eyes, the way it was meant to be. And what he meant by that is people used to come to the distillery and fill up their quart jug there right at the distillery, and it came straight from the barrel. We didn't cut it to bottling strength or any of that.
Right, with the old tub, right?
That's what bourbon was all about, was kind of getting back to the you know, the roots of bourbon. Barrel strength was the first, you know, barrel strength bourbon. You know, it was creating small batch, which was at that time unheard of as well. And now you see small batch went from something that we called the collection of Booker's Bakers, Basil Hayden, and Knob Creek. Now that's a whole segment in the entire industry. So, you know, it's another way of expanding that. And I think getting it at cash strength for Little Book was especially key for me once I started to think about it. And then someone in our packaging group said, hey, that was your nickname by your grandfather. What if you just call it Little Book? And it just instantly stuck with everybody on the team. And so that's where you see the name Little Book come from. And really, as I said before, that the premise of it is exploring whiskey. You know, I've got a very curious mind when it comes to the distillery and when it comes to looking at barrels in the warehouse. And so Little Book is that kind of place for me to kind of let the world look under the hood at some of the things that I'm keen to or come to like through just blending and spending time with some of our blending team and product development. And so you'll see the first chapter, as I said, it comes out once a year. And so at first it wasn't chapter. We just called it Little Book, The Easy. And I thought it was a very easy sipper for a 128 proof and a blend. And it was a kind of a rendition on that blend that I just told you guys about from my R&D time. It was actually a blend of 4-year-old Jim Beam at cask strength, blended with 13-year-old corn whiskey. So again, you're taking down a little bit of that kind of grainy note from the corn whiskey. I mean, at 13 years old, that's almost unheard of in corn whiskey terms, to be honest. A 6-year-old, 100% distiller's malt, malted whiskey. So again, a little more age, getting some different characters developing. And then a 6-year-old, and I don't know, we had a Booker's Rye release, which was a higher rye than our normal rye. And it essentially, we reran this and I used a 6-year-old version of it. So you see less corn in that. So I was trying to pull away from that inspiration or my initial thought, pull away from that brunt of corn that was coming through. And I really liked where Chapter One landed. I thought it was a great representation of a blended bourbon. And that's kind of what I went to calling it as I was speaking about it. From there, I went and I used some, kind of went more of a rye whiskey note, pulling out some fruity, some estuary, some floral notes with Chapter Two. And I used our 8-year-old Kentucky straight rye with 40-year-old Canadian whiskey that was corn-based, so kind of close to a bourbon mash bill, and then also a 13-year-old rye whiskey that was aged in a recharred barrel. So again, pulling a little more flavor from the barrel, but also getting some inspiration from some great whiskey I tasted while I was in Canada at our sister distillery in Alberta. So it kind of took you, and that one was called No Simple Task. I went through 54 different kind of prototypes before I got to narrowing, and I was a little bit worried. You know, I thought the first one went great. This one was taking a little bit longer than I was expecting, and yeah, so it got No Simple Task as the title. And the third one was called The Road Home, which was kind of coincidentally the year my son was born. We were looking at kicking off this craft distillery build. So my boss had said, hey, you know, take some time, spend it with your family in the fall. I didn't do I usually kind of run around the country and promote Little Book during the fall time to tell the story and do deconstructed tastings of the blend. And so I didn't do that for this chapter. We actually brought some writers down to the distillery. So they came to my home versus me going around. So that one, and that was a blend of that small batch collection. And so it was very fitting to be called The Road Home. You know, it was the first bourbon blend, actual bourbon blend of the series. And those whiskeys mean a lot to me, you know, Knob Creek, Basil, Booker's, Baker's. My dad spent a long time of his career promoting those brands. And obviously my grandfather crafted them. So there's just, and I really like how that one landed as well. And then the last one, Lessons Honored, you know, everyone compares me a lot to my grandfather. But if it wasn't for my dad, you know, I never spent a day working with my grandfather. If it wasn't for my dad and him kind of fielding my crazy off the wall questions and guiding me in places or in more often than not, letting me kind of run free with my thoughts and trusting me that I, you know, had some good thought behind what I was doing. And then bouncing those things and saying, you know, what would Granddaddy say about this? Or what did he say when he talked about that? So to me, Chapter Four was called Lessons Honored. And it was the lessons of honor for my dad. You know, it wasn't for my grandfather on this one. You know, the brand is kind of an honor to my grandfather and our connection. This batch was, I let my dad work on selecting one of the whiskeys for it. So he chose a 7-year-old Kentucky straight bourbon, which ended up being a Knob Creek variant. So Knob Creek has sometimes been claimed to be his favorite from time to time. Typically, we don't say we have favorites because we do, and both of us really do kind of rotate around the brands and drink each of them.
Sure.
But so this was a blend of his favorite, which was that one, that 7-year-old version of Knob Creek, and an 8-year-old High Rye, which represents that actual, that Booker's Rye mash bill again, which is one that him and I worked on together. And then the last one was a 4-year-old brown rice bourbon, which is kind of cool because it's actually the first project that he kind of let me run the reins on. He was traveling and they wanted somebody to go visit the brown rice fields and understand more about what we might be developing from this grain. And so that's the third of those three. And so, like I say, it's all about kind of that connection with my dad, and the three whiskeys used, they worked very well together, and it came together that I had that thought of doing an honor for my father in my head. And then, as I said, I let these whiskeys and I started working and we started blending. And then I started seeing, well, this brown rice does really well with this high rye. I said, so we started putting some bourbon in it. And I said, well, I'm going to let my dad pick what this final one is. And I'll just do the diligence of making sure that I find the best version of these three whiskeys. And it's so cool how it all fell together. And that's, as you see, it tells personal story. I look at Little Book as maybe a chapter. Each chapter represents pieces of my whiskey journey, whether that's, as I said before, whiskey is such a part of my life, and our family has been such a part of whiskey. They're so intertwined that, I think it's important that you hear some of the personal side of it, that you learn a little bit maybe about, you learn that I am curious about whiskey and travel to Canada. I tell you guys, I've been to Japan twice since that time frame to learn Japanese whiskey. It's telling you a little bit about me, telling you personal stories of the connections I had with my family, my dad and grandfather. And I'm sure maybe it'll tell you some stories about some of my coworkers, maybe my mom, my wife, who knows?
Right.
my kids even, or it may go back more into process, but I think what I'd like for everyone to know is that the whiskey is kind of guiding this journey, and that hopefully I've got a story to tell through the whiskey, and I'll share it with the world each year.
I mean, it sounds incredible, and I'm going to definitely get my, as life comes back to life here in New York, I'm going to get myself a couple of bottles. How much of each chapter do you produce each year?
So it's a very limited run. It's about half the size of a batch of Booker's. We don't talk a lot about the case volumes and such. So, with Booker's being small batch, you can assume that it's much smaller than our batches of Jim Beam. And then this is a half a size of that. And really, I guess the premise of that is that I want this to be something that, each story gets its time. And so by releasing it in the August timeframe, it kind of gets its own rollout. And then my goal is that it kind of is hopefully off shelves by Christmas time. It'd be a great gift as well. But then it gives that time, you see it, you could probably find it in stores now, definitely. But I guess the large percentage of it is during that time frame. And it lets each batch kind of have its own life before the next one's sitting there beside it.
I think that's brilliant on both a sort of intriguing level for the consumer, and also sounds like a pretty smart business proposition as well.
Well, with that, I think, if you look through the list of whiskeys I ran through there, you don't have a surplus of a lot of those things.
Yeah, 40-year-old Canadian.
special barrelings, those things don't come in large quantities. So it makes it a little bit easier when you're working in a pretty small batch size as well, to be able to kind of keep the curiosity there. If you started telling me I had to scale it up to a size of a batch of Booker's, well, I would say the breadth that I would be able to achieve in the short term would go down. Now I say in the short term because it kind of segues to the craft distillery I've mentioned. We're building a smaller scale replica of our Clermont distillery, to do some more of this innovation. I guess I kind of got people anxious and excited to say, hey, this guy's got a curious mind. What else can he do? And as you all know, whiskey's very high demand right now. Still time is of the essence. So having a facility where we can kind of scale back the Booker's and the Baker's production under my watchful eye, as well as these kind of innovation mash bills and innovation operating techniques, I'll say, it's given us a good facility to go and kind of get deeper into that curiosity. And hopefully it looks to be the opportunity for us to expand that American whiskey category, start getting more barrels to research and hopefully start sharing them with the world. You know, that's my thing is I think there is a whiskey, whether it's out there yet or not, but I think there's an American whiskey out there for everyone. It just hasn't been found yet. And with that, I'm very curious. My wife laughs at me when I cook because I'll change something every time. I'm like, I didn't like that as much. She's like, well, you said that's the best you had the time before, so why are you messing with it? And I just, it's always about making it better, yeah, you know, or can it be better? And so I'm hoping that with Little Book and with this craft distillery, we can get to a place where we really know the kind of width and depth that the American whiskey category, which is a pretty big one if you step back from bourbon and rye and American single malt and, and then you go deeper into the realms of that. There's different types of grains you can use within each of those categories. So I'm excited to really start tapping into that depth and width and start telling that story and having people see and latch onto maybe some of those flavors. It could bring you closer to some other brands that are already out there, you know? So it's a journey. It's a whiskey journey.
Yeah, and I love that. I think that's that's what creativity is, you know? I mean, it's if you let something fly and just say, "Yeah, that's good enough. That'll do." Then, you know, that's where creativity dies. I love the constant, you know, like this is really good, but I'm going to see what I can do different and see if it makes something maybe better or maybe just it takes you in an interesting direction that you never thought of before the next time, you know? I think it's super cool to see that, you know, you're an eighth generation steward of this legacy that isn't just resting on the laurels of what's come before. You're constantly trying to see, okay, what else can we do? Where else can we explore here, you know?
Absolutely. And I think too, you know, tapping back into that curiosity about my ancestry and my history and learning why the brands that we have on the shelf were created, you know, you find that curiosity and then you find ways that curiosity can maybe help tell more stories about those brands or maybe, you know, you find that this thing here probably needs to have its own brand or own story, you know, and that's when it becomes really rich and you really start to kind of change where the trajectory of American whiskey sits when you start to dive out deeper than just fitting within certain parameters. And so I think hopefully in the near and longer term future, you guys will start to see that we'll have some of these releases that you'll see coming out on brands as well as coming in into probably new areas as well as new grains or new barreling opportunities or aging or even distillation techniques could change the way we release certain whiskeys, you know?
Yeah, it's a fascinating world.
I can't wait, man.
Yeah, it's a fascinating world, and it's got plenty of room for exploration. And, really very appreciative of you sharing this much story with us today and looking forward to continuing to hear and literally see and definitely taste the story as it moves forward. Thanks so much for your time today and for sharing all this stuff about yourself, your family, and your whiskey. This has been one of the more fascinating shows we've done in some time. So I really do appreciate you being here, Freddie.
Yeah. Again, thank you guys. Anytime, be glad to come back and we can dive into more and different pieces. Glad to have the opportunity. You know, as I said before, I'm just glad to have the opportunity to have people kind of listen to my family story and be able to share it. I think it's such a great piece of my job, I guess, you know, is kind of spreading that word of the Beam family history. And then as you see, hopefully I can bring to life some whiskey elements that help enhance that story and keep people understanding that, you know, there's been one family that's been around since this industry has started and they're still there helping to kind of usher along and have that pride in making whiskey and keep it going for generations to come, hopefully.
I mean, without a doubt, it's here to stay. Well, that's it for this week's episode of The Speakeasy. Thank you so much to Fred Noe from Jim Beam, eighth generation Beam distiller. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today and taking us on this journey. It's been fascinating and intriguing. And as is always the case, when the show feels like it went by so quickly, that just means we have to have you back on again. And I look forward to maybe having an opportunity to travel down there, see the new craft distillery that you're putting together, and have a face-to-face interview with you in the future. If we can get that worked out. But that's it for this week's episode of the Speakeasy Team. Thank you so much for joining us. Join us again next week, and we'll see you soon. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.